Hello all, and welcome to the teleclass, What to Look For and Ask For When Evaluating Cleaning and Disinfecting Products in 5 Easy Steps. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of Professor Syed Sattar, the co-founder of Teleclass Education, I will say thank you very much for joining us today. The presenter for this lecture is a key member of Professor Sattar's team at the Center for Research on Environmental Microbiology at the University of Ottawa. Jason Tetreault has been a good friend for many years and my go-to guy when I have questions on disinfection and sterilization. Jason has been in the scientific community for more than 2 decades. He has worked on diagnostic technologies and he's developed expertise in the food, water, and blood-borne fields. After various stints in industry and government, he joined Syed Sattar at the University of Ottawa to be a researcher and coordinator. Jason has many publications to his name. He is a popular conference lecturer. He is a regular on Ottawa radio and television talking about environmental hygiene in the home. And with all that, he is also an accomplished writer and filmmaker. He's known to me as JT, and it is a great pleasure to have him with us today. Let me also acknowledge Virox Technologies, Inc. as the sponsor of this teleclass, and I thank them very much for their ongoing support of teleclass education. So from the University of Ottawa, to present what to look for and ask for when evaluating cleaning and disinfecting products in 5 easy steps, I give you the one and the only Jason Tetreault. JT.
Thanks, Paul. I have quite a bit to get through here, so I just want to say hello, and I hope I don't go too fast, but we do have a lot of ground to cover, because when Paul asked me to do this teleclass, what to ask for and look for when evaluating cleaning, disinfecting products in 5 easy steps, I sat back and I thought about the entire gambit when it came to cleaning and disinfecting. And to bring that down into 5 steps that you can take with you after this teleclass seemed a bit challenging. However, we did manage to do that. I was able to talk with some of my colleagues, and we were able to create 5 steps or objectives for this teleclass, and I'm hoping that you will be able to take this with you, not only from your own personal and professional work, but also in terms of the group work that you do. So I'm just going to quickly go through them. Objectives. You want to assess, which is to best understand the current state of microbial challenges in healthcare settings requiring cleaning and disinfection. You want to analyze, which is to best understand how to inactivate undesirable microbes in the environment. You want to acquire, which is to understand which disinfectants and cleaning products are effective against the target pathogens. You want to apply, which is how to read the labels, follow instructions, and ensure that proper procedures are being used. And finally, which is a huge one as we move sort of into the second decade of the 21st century, audit, which is to ensure that cleaning disinfection products and procedures being used are in actual fact working. So we're first going to move on to assess. And the big picture is, what are we dealing with and what are the implications? Well, when we're talking about cleaning and disinfection, we really are talking about microbial challenges. And there's a good reason for that, because there are well over 1,400 known pathogens for humans, and about 200 of them, we still don't know exactly how they spread. When we do usually find out how they've spread, it's because there's been an outbreak or an epidemic or a pandemic, and unfortunately, that is the reality of microbiology. So what we want to do is we want to try and find ways to prevent this from happening. In the last 30 years, we've had some 300 new and emerging infectious diseases, and you've probably heard of a few of them, such as SARS, H1N1, MRSA, C. difficile, and MDR, XDR, TB. These are just a few, but these are the ones that usually make the headlines. Each pathogen also comes with its specific physical, chemical, and biological properties. And I'm going to get into those in a moment, but I just wanted to give you a quick breakdown of what we're dealing with when we talk about pathogens. This is from about 10 years ago, this pie chart, and it's A little dated, but for the most part, the numbers are close. And we're looking at around 538, 540 bacteria, 217 viruses and prions, 307 fungi, 66 protozoa, and 287 helminths. What I find interesting is about 50 years ago, many of those helminths that we now consider to be pathogens actually were part of our normal flora. But due to the hygienic improvements that occur in our daily lives, helminths kind of lost their favor and as a result became anathema, which then led to us not wanting them. And then they changed while being in the environment and decided that they wanted to be pathogenic. This actually does happen quite a bit in the evolution of microbes and pathogens. There's not a heck of a lot we can do about it. All right, moving to bacteria. Bacteria, when we talk about cleaning, this is what we're really talking about, is bacteria. So bacteria, essentially, they're everywhere. I keep seeing now, you know, this idea that germs are everywhere. Well, in reality, bacteria are everywhere. We're hoping that viruses and other things aren't everywhere. There are really two kinds of pathogens that we need to worry about in the hospital. Those are gram-positive bacteria, and you'll recognize the names, Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, Bacillus. There's lots more. Gram-negative, Escherichia, Pseudomonas, and more recently, Acinetobacter. This is another one of those bacteria that actually was relatively harmless until we actually started having immunocompromisation. And Acinetobacter started enjoying colonizing individuals. And so, of course, we thought it was anathema. We started to fight it. We started to go against it. And sure enough, it turned into a multi-drug resistant pathogen, which is now causing major problems in many hospitals. Bacteria, for the most part, are generally easy to kill with disinfection and, of course, with antisepsis. There is the potential for having biofilms, but usually bacteria need another kind of source in order for that to occur, and that's Mycobacteria, which is the next slide. We all know about Mycobacterium tuberculosis. However, there are many non-tuberculosis or environmental types that actually cause disease, and we're starting to see a heck of a lot more of that in immunocompromised individuals. What's ironic, and I just gave a lecture on the immune response and pharmacological ingredients. And what we find is that because there's such a huge amount of pharmacological ingredients now which are trying to stem the tide of cytokine storms and immune responses, we're starting to see immunocompromisation everywhere. And so as a result, mycobacteria are becoming much more prevalent, and you're probably going to hear a lot more about these NTMs, as we call them. Anyways, they are, they're slow-growing, hard to grow in the lab, and they're fairly resistant because when they form this biofilm, or they form the basis of a biofilm, they essentially just stick in there, and they're very difficult to get rid of. So this is one of the reasons why we encourage, you know, normal or regular cleaning, because if you do start getting any kind of biofilm, you're starting to deal with a heck of a lot more of a problem. Mycobacteria are, again, not that big of a deal, but when you start getting into bacterial spores, now you're getting into a bit of the sort of the big daddy problem. And as we all know, Clostridium difficile, which again was another one of these normal bugs that suddenly turned into a pathogen and became a major problem, is, for the most part, ubiquitous. And now that we're starting to see these drug-resistant and these super virulent versions actually in the environment, now we're having major issues. We used to have hospital Clostridium difficile. Now we have community C. difficile. And it's becoming a major problem. The other thing is that when you look at C. difficile, and I've also mentioned tetanus and anthrax here because they also are spore formers, they're very, very difficult to kill. And you have to use very strong chemicals in order to inactivate them. And we're going to get into that in a little bit, but I just wanted to put that in your brain right now. Viruses. We all know of the viruses. There are obviously two different forms. There are the envelope viruses. There are also the non-envelope viruses. The best way to look at it is envelope viruses, which are influenza, coronavirus, HIV, very easy to kill and inactivate. And you can use soap and water for the most part, and you won't have to worry about enveloped. Non-enveloped viruses, on the other hand, such as norovirus, poliovirus, adenovirus, rotavirus, they're very difficult to kill. Not quite as difficult as spores, and I'll get into that in a little bit, but you do need to be very rigorous in your cleaning and disinfection methods for this. Fungi have essentially been a problem for the ages. They can come in two forms, the yeast or the filamentous fungi, and they have become a major problem, again, in immunosuppressed individuals. And we all know of people who have HIV or HIV seropositive presenting with symptoms of thrush. We also know of Cryptococcus neoformans, which is also another problem with respect to these individuals. And now we're actually starting to see variants of penicillium, which we've used to create antibiotics in the past. Well, now this is actually causing major issues when it comes to the health and welfare of these individuals. In terms of fungi, they're probably not as ubiquitous in their yeast and filamentous forms, but they also create spores in the same way as bacteria, and these spores happen to be pretty much anywhere and everywhere. So when you're in a hospital environment, if you're not keeping up the regular cleaning, there's a good likelihood you're going to have a buildup of spores of fungus, and then that can actually get into an individual and lead to disease. Protozoa, these are microscopic single-celled animals. They are very, very complex, and depending on what protozoan you're dealing with, you're going to come into a life cycle that probably is six stages in long and probably has three or four different types of hosts and various environmental factors. The one thing that I can essentially say when it comes to protozoa is they're very, very difficult to kill, and sometimes even what you would normally expect to kill, these things just will not. I do want to bring your attention to Toxoplasma gondii. It, again, has been one of those parasites that wasn't particularly a problem for many, many years. Yes, there were problems with respect to cats and also to pregnant women. And if you have any questions on that, I can help you. But now we're actually starting to see Toxoplasma actually causing morbidity and even mortality in just regular, average, ordinary folk. So once again, we're starting to see this evolution take place, and we have to just be more diligent in our cleaning and disinfection. Prions seem to have gone the other way. Prions were huge about 15 years ago. With the new variant CJD or mad cow disease, it was popularized. However, more recently, we've been able to control the spread of it in the environment, and therefore we're not really worried too much about CJD when it comes to cleaning and disinfection. It still does occur. We do have sporadic cases of the actual Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, and as a result, we have to be absolutely diligent when there is a suspected case in order to get rid of it. However, normal disinfection and cleaning will not do anything to these prions. And you actually need, as I've stated here, 134 degrees for 18 minutes or 121 degrees for 30 minutes or one normal sodium hydroxide for 15 minutes. Anyone who's done their chemistry understands that that's just very, very, very problematic for anybody. And so really, once you start looking at prions, you're getting into an environment that's just beyond regular cleaning and disinfection. Okay, so now we know what we're up against. So now we have to analyze a way that we can make our environment safe. And on the next slide, and I do apologize for the quality, the key message here is that in order for us to be able to prevent the spread of pathogens, we have to somehow find a way to interrupt the regular transients from one place to another. And the way we do this is through cleaning, disinfection, and asepsis. And I do have sterilization here, although I'm not going to get too much into that. When it comes to cleaning and disinfection and antisepsis, however, one thing that is clear is that we really do need to use microbicides. You've probably heard the term germicide. You've probably heard bactericide, viricide. All of these can be clumped under one category, which is microbicide. And so I'm going to discuss microbicides here. the first thing that you need to know is that when it comes to disinfectants and antiseptics, the real difference is really where you're going to be applying it. Antiseptics is essentially for the skin, disinfectants is for surfaces, but that everything else is pretty much the same. So as I'm going through what we're discussing, don't worry too much about whether I'm talking about disinfection or antisepsis. I'm actually referring to both. Issues for consideration are the same. The claims of each active ingredient, physical environment, microbial resistance, and of course application environment. In this case, we're talking about what exactly are you putting it on, what is the condition of what you're putting it on, and also is what you're using as a microbicide sufficient in order to clean and or disinfect or provide antisepsis to that particular surface. And again, we'll get into that in a little bit. But the first thing I need to do is talk about a little bit about the physical factors. So when we talk about pH, microbicides have specific pH optimal levels. Let's take bleach, for instance. The best active is below 5.0. When you're talking about an aldehyde, it's actually higher at around 8.0. So you have to ensure that in order to have the best activity, you have to have the best physical condition. Temperature is also something that is very important. Now, we all talk about room temperature. And the problem is that the room temperature in a place in a hospital in Kenya is not going to be the same as the room temperature in a hospital in Inuvik. So what we do is we look at room temperature as being anywhere between about 17 degrees and 25 degrees Celsius. In terms of antiseptics, we are looking at 33 degrees Celsius, which is around the optimal skin temperature for a regular individual. Relative humidity, this is almost a branch of science in and of itself. So all I'm going to say here is that when you're talking about relative humidity, these particular targets, viruses and bacteria and fungi, are going to have preferences for a particular RH. And as a result of that, if you are in a particular RH that is preferential, then you're going to have a harder time killing. In terms of actual use, we try and have an optimal range of between 40 and 60%. The reason for that is that gives us at least an idea as to how we can standardize the relative humidity as it relates to the active and as it relates to the environment. The equations get polynomial and multifactorial when it comes to actually figuring out how to change relative humidity, and it's outside the scope of this talk, at least. Microbial resistance. Resistance is a major issue to consider, and the reason is that target organisms are going to be able to resist, to some extent, what you're putting on, the active. The active itself has to be at a sufficient level to be able to overcome this resistance. And if you don't, then the bacterium, virus, whatever it might be, is actually going to be able to withstand and then potentially even mutate into something that is even more resistant. So when we talk about microbial resistance, think of it this way. There's a general resistance to everything. If you don't overcome that general resistance, you're going to create a specific resistance. And if you don't overcome that specific resistance, then you're going to develop a specialized resistance. And that specialized resistance is what we call multi-drug resistance or anything along those lines. So take that into consideration. And as we move forward, you'll start to appreciate how what I've just said now is going to be important when you move away from this teleclass. The next slide, again, is not the best quality, but it just gives you an idea as to the relative microbial resistance to disinfection, starting with vegetative bacteria and viruses and moving up to bacterial spores. And prions are completely off the chart, so we're not even going to discuss that. And as for the disinfection level, we like to call disinfectants low, intermediate, high. Well, this just gives you an idea as to why we call them that, because they obviously have a scope over a particular kind of resistance. They're able to to overcome a particular kind of resistance. The other thing I should say is that when you actually do start seeing resistance, say a vegetative bacterium develops a resistance to a disinfectant, then that's going to start going up the chart. So the relative resistance portion can be, unfortunately, dynamic. In terms of those disinfection levels, I'm just going to quickly go through this. A cold sterilant, which essentially kills all organisms. High-level disinfectant sometimes will not kill bacteria spores. Intermediate-level disinfectant will kill mycobacteria, most viruses, and bacteria. And then low-level disinfectant essentially is going to only kill some non-envelope some envelope viruses. I get mixed up as well, and also regular bacteria. And when it comes to cleaning, you're usually looking at a low-level disinfectant. Okay, so now you know pretty much what you have to do. So let's figure out what we're going to get. So how can we tell the difference between disinfectants and cleaning products? Part of this is going to seem like review for some of you, and I apologize, but I really do believe that we should be going through this and making sure that we understand what our actives are. I should also state that there might be a little bit of questioning with respect to various actives, and if you have any types of questions for me, please feel free to send them to Paul, and he'll send them to me, and then that way we can be sure everybody is on the same level. Okay, so factors in choosing an active. Materials compatibility, essentially what are you putting it on and what is it going to work with? Dosage rate of application. I say here the least amount of active as infrequent as possible. That more is a what we call a cost-benefit term. In reality, you want to try and use as much as you can to overcome those resistance hurdles so you don't have to deal with future resistance. Training and ease of use, well, we're going to get into personal protection in a little bit. Open and closed environments are going to be very key when we get into some of the sterilant discussions. And, of course, there are dilution considerations, which I will get into shortly. And then, of course, there's the safety of personnel and environment. Odor is one specific thing. Environmental pollution is another. And, of course, there are exposure limits. So, I wanted to also mention that a lot of this that we're looking at here in this particular slide is done at the research and development level, the R&D level, so that when it actually is released for use, a lot of these things have already been figured out. So I'm just going to take us through a list of the actives that are popular. And I may miss one or two that perhaps are new, but these ones have been researched thoroughly, and as a result, the information that's provided is fairly sound. I know that there are definitely some other novel disinfectant and antiseptic actives that are coming out, but again, until we have the scientific literature upon which I can base a discussion, I would prefer not to venture essentially what would be guesstimates. So I apologize if I miss one of your favorite actives. Chlorine, gas, liquid, or powder? Well, chlorine is the most widely used microbicide. It is effective against most pathogens and disruption of cell walls, membranes, and proteins. Essentially, chlorine is a ionic destabilizer, which then destabilizes anything that has the potential to be ionized. As a result of that, you start to see acidification and the breakdown. And this is one of the reasons why chlorine works best at the lower pHs. We use sodium hypochlorite bleach, and it's used quite often, almost anywhere and everywhere. I still remember my colleague telling me that he was in the deepest part of Africa, and he walked into a general store and there was bleach, and he kind of wondered why there would be bleach in the middle of Africa, and he said that's what they use to clean. That's what everybody uses to clean. So if you say that, you're pretty much in the same boat. As for alternatives to sodium hypochlorite, there is chlorine gas now, which is being used for water and sewage disinfection, and chlorine dioxide and monochloramine are starting to be used for water disinfection as well. That's because there is the potential for the formation of byproducts, which some consider to be unhealthy. However, those things have yet to be absolutely proven. The other thing about chlorine is that depending on the concentration you use, you can pretty much inactivate anything except perhaps for parasites such as protozoa and possibly Legionella, which has a very good chlorine resistance. I was talking about odor earlier. When I moved to phenolic compounds, I just wanted to share a story. The people in my apartment building, when they do their daily cleaning, they actually use Dettol. And I'm sure that all of you are familiar with the smell of Dettol. And I smile every time I smell that every morning because it makes me realize that, yes, they're doing a good job in cleaning. That's what odor actually does. It gives you that sense that things are clean. However, when it comes to actual activity, because what it does is it breaks down lipid layers, especially proteolipid layers, it's really good against bacteria, mycobacteria, and envelope viruses. But when you start getting to the non-envelope viruses, because there's no lipid there, it's very, very difficult for it to break it down. And many of the other microbes that have cell walls or capsules, they're also very difficult to kill using phenolic compounds. So there's not a heck of a lot that is potentially useful past the intermediate level when it comes to phenolics. I should also say that toxicity needs to be understood because phenol by itself actually is a natural human toxin. You do definitely not want to get that on your skin, and you surely do not want to get that through one of your portals of entry. However, that being said, resorcinol, which is a phenolic compound, is actually one of the main components in your throat lozenges when you have a sore throat. So obviously it's all a matter of concentration, very much like bleach. Moving on to surfactants. Surfactants essentially are the bridge between oil and water. So when you put a surfactant in, you get those bubbles that form. And what that really is doing is it's creating a bridge so that oil and water can be mixed together. And that is fabulous when it comes to creating a soap, because what happens is that the lipid layer that you have for a cell, bacterium or otherwise, is trying to keep in a particular amount of aqueous solution and keep out a particular kind of aqueous solution and then only allowing through pores or whatever it might be. Well, what surfactants do is they essentially dissolve that layer so that now you have leaking. And as a result of that leaking, you start to see these cells either grow very, very large or grow very, very tiny. Either way, they get inactivated or killed. The only problem is that you do need to have that lipid layer. And again, bacteria and envelope viruses are very susceptible to surfactants. However, non-envelope viruses, mycobacteria, and spores especially, they're not particularly great against surfactants. There are two other things with surfactants that have come to light. One is that the development of resistance to surfactants has become a concern, and it's slowly becoming a major concern as many resistant variants of certain bacteria are showing to have similar gene structures. And that means that if this gene essentially becomes ubiquitous, then you're going to have surfactant resistant bacteria along the same lines as MRSA. There's also the environmental concern because when you put a surfactant into the environment, it's very difficult to break down. And as a result, people worry about bioaccumulation and what that may do to nature. I can't really comment on that. However, I'm sure that if you were to take a look, you would probably find both regular as well as gray literature discussing that. Moving on to aldehydes, these are very good because they fix proteins. And what that means is, if you look at my image here, you'll notice that you have either a methyl group or some kind of hydrocarbon group and an oxygen. And what happens is that oxygen literally fuses that methyl group onto a protein, thereby making it either denser or unable to actually do its function. And as a result of that, you're essentially choking off the ability of the cell to do its activities, and then it dies. Formaldehyde is the classic aldehyde, but glutaraldehyde has been the one that's been used the most when it comes to healthcare and cleaning and disinfection. And it's actually a very, very good chemical to use. It does have a very good ability against pretty much anything, and was essentially the go-to on top. If you couldn't use bleach, then you can go to glutaraldehyde. I mean, I was using that 15, 20 years ago. Unfortunately, we've known a heck of a lot more about glutaraldehyde and its toxicity, and as a result, you're starting to see less of an interest in glutaraldehyde, and even in Europe, while it hasn't necessarily become gospel, it is becoming very knowledgeable that you should try and find alternate forms to glutaraldehyde. And I've mentioned orthophthalic aldehyde here because that is one particular one, OPA. Metals. I'm not going to get into this too much. The controversy still continues. However, what is known is that several metals do have toxic effects on bacteria. And in particular, you're looking at copper and silver as your antimicrobials. Copper is now being used in surfaces such as the stainless steel surfaces that you find in a hospital. They're now looking at impregnating copper into that. Silver is being used in textiles and other implements such as medical devices. The problem with these metals is that there has to be actual contact between the metal and the infectious agent. And if you don't have contact, then you're not going to be able to have an antimicrobial effect. So if you remember to what I was talking about earlier, where if you don't have regular cleaning, you could create a biofilm. Well, if you have a biofilm that's even one cell thick, then anything that's on top of that one cell thick biofilm is not going to be touched by the copper or the silver, and as a result is going to thrive. So metals in particular, if they're going to be used, are going to need an even greater regimen of cleaning and disinfection simply to be sure that there's nothing on them. And we're in a position where we're seeing less environmental cleaning, not more. So I will leave that up to other people to argue, but until we have a proper harmony, metals are a little bit of a concern. Peroxygens. Oxygen has been probably one of the best routes to inactivate microbes. The development of a free radical essentially attacks and destroys both lipid and protein layers, and therefore oxygen and the free radicals from oxygen are essentially useful throughout the entire spectrum of microbes. We are seeing hydrogen peroxide and peracetic acid being very important as we move forward. And a lot of research has been done over the last 15 to 20 years, and we have seen this sort of new wave of hydrogen peroxide as sort of the new disinfectant. That, to some extent, is true. However, you have to understand that these, especially in the case of hydrogen peroxide, has to be stabilized as well as accelerated. And as a result of that, you have to have a specific kind of hydrogen peroxide solution in order for it to work. If you just go into your drugstore and you pick up the hydrogen peroxide in the brown bottle and you use that, you're not going to get very far. Peracetic acid, on the other hand, doesn't need any kind of stabilizers, really. It just works, except that it works too well. And so you need various kinds of protective personal protective equipment, PPE, which I'll refer to after this, in order to be absolutely sure that you don't get this on your hands, you don't get this anywhere near you. So, again, you're starting to play that balance. The only other thing that I can really say about peroxygens is that in fairness to the surfactants and the phenolics and the glutaraldehydes, the fact is that you are seeing only oxygen being used, and therefore from hydrogen peroxide by itself, there's no residue and it's environmentally safe. However, because you do need to have some of these other components, these excipients, you have to be very much aware that there might be something there after you've used it. Whether or not that provides an environmental threat, I quite honestly don't have the research to say one way or the other. In terms of alcohols, alcohols are fixatives, and they essentially disrupt the protein structure by breaking down the wall between the oil and the water in the same way as a surfactant does. But in this particular case, what it does is it actually changes the structure of water so that it takes on a more dense and more compact entity. And as a result of that, you literally squish the proteins together. And when you've done that, after it dries, they stay squished and are inactive. We see two major alcohol types. One is ethanol, which is usually between 62 and 80%, which is a good wide-spectrum microbicide, and isopropanol, or rubbing alcohol, which is between 60 and 95%, which has been shown to only be a good bactericide. Both ethanol and isopropanol are ineffective against spores, and there has been concern over concentration for use. In terms of our work in our lab, we are showing that 62% may be the best concentration to use. We just had that published in PLOS One, and I would be more than happy to share that link with you so that you can then look at our research and see why we say this. But a take-home message from the paper, and one that I'm going to share with you right now, is it doesn't matter what the concentration happens to be. You have to have a long enough contact time along with a good maintenance of wet on the hands in order for alcohol to work. Okay, so I'm just going to quickly go through cold sterilization. It is part of the disinfection process. However, in order for you to use sterilants, you have to be under highly controlled settings. And as a result, you can't just simply go in there and say, I'm going to use a cold sterilant. You have to involve several aspects of the hospital environment in order for this to work. This really isn't about cleaning. This isn't about disinfection. This is about when you have a high-risk event that requires you to use something that is stronger than anything else you've got on your shelf. And the perfect example of that is in the case where you have prions. If you have any kind of prion, you go straight to cold sterilants. I should also mention here before I go into the actual sterilants themselves that, as I mentioned, if you are going to be using it, you're going to have to be highly trained because you're going to have to involve personal protective equipment, and you're also going to have to use specified procedures. Okay, ozone. I've already talked about how oxygen works. Ozone essentially is 3 oxygens, so you can see how this is going to make, I guess, triple the activity, if you wish. It's absolutely fabulous, and after a rainstorm, you get that wonderful spring air smell. That's ozone, and that's great. Problem is that those levels are about 1 to 5 parts per billion that you're recognizing. In terms of what we need to be able to kill, you're talking about 1 to 3 parts per million. So you're thinking thousands of times more than what you would smell after a rainstorm. Unfortunately, the threshold for humans, as they've done with tests, is about less than 1 part per million per day. So in order for you to be able to work with ozone, you have to use a maximum, of 10 times less concentration than what is effective against your agents. So as a result of that, in order for it to be used properly, you have to either be in a completely controlled environment with proper personal protective equipment so that you're not exposed to the ozone, or you put it into a controlled, enclosed environment that would look like an autoclave. And this is one of the directions that some people have been, or some companies have been going. Ethylene oxide is also using the power of oxygen, but more or less in the same way as glutaraldehyde. And so what happens is you're alkylating or you're adding those hydrocarbon residues to whatever your target is. Ethylene oxide is not necessarily as toxic as ozone. However, it still requires you to work with less than 5 ppm a day. And I still remember reading a paper from several years ago where they actually put some people into a room and provided some ethylene oxide to see whether or not they would be able to withstand the part per million concentrations necessary to kill. And, they were done before it even got to 5 ppm. However, in order for it to work, you may be needing up to 1,500 ppm. So again, you're talking so much higher concentrations than what you can withstand, and therefore you either need the personal protective equipment or you have to have that in closed space. Then we get into gaseous hydrogen peroxide. I've already talked about hydrogen peroxide, but in this particular case, you're essentially vaporizing it. So once you've taken that unstable oxygen and you've put that into a fog, it doesn't matter what it touches, it's going to react. So you can absolutely imagine how if you are in an environment that has this kind of gaseous or damp hydrogen peroxide fog, you'd be in some trouble. So in the case of gaseous hydrogen peroxide, while there does seem to be a lot of interest in it, and there does seem to be some adoption of it, including here at the University of Ottawa, where our Level 3 facility is completely sterilized using the gaseous hydrogen peroxide, you also should take note that the standard operating procedures, the PPE, and the entire group of people who are involved just in the process of disinfection and sterilization using gaseous hydrogen peroxide is unbelievable. And so while it may be great and it might be the new wave, is it really worth in terms of an administrative and cost level to take it on? That's something that I don't believe any of us can decide here during this teleclass. Okay, so the next slide is the overview of activities. I want this to be what you take home, because once you've gotten to this, you'll be able to say, okay, I've got sodium hypochlorite, and I'm using 1,000 ppm, and that gives me activity against bacteria, envelope viruses, non-envelope viruses, fungi, and mycobacteria. Now, all of this activity has been shown in papers and publications, so if there are any questions with respect to why, say, hydrogen peroxide at only 3% has only bactericidal activity, whereas accelerated hydrogen peroxide at 7.5% has this whole gamut, just send a note to Paul. He can send that to me, and I can get you some papers on that. Okay, so now that we've gone through all of those, we want to figure out how can we apply. And this is very important because this is where you, as the person who's going to be doing the cleaning, or your staff, the people who are going to be doing the cleaning, play the major role. My next slide, I've produced a label which I took from the Center for Food Security and Public Health at Iowa State University. The reason I've done this is I want to just give an example of what a product label looks like. And more importantly, in the little squared section, I want you to notice that that's actually where the directions for use are. So you have this label, regardless of how large it might be, but only a small portion of that is actually going to be your use directions. Considering what we've gone through, you would expect that there'd be more to discuss as to how to use it. However, that isn't necessarily the case, and as a result, as on the next slide, we see directions on the label can lead to confusion. I just bring up the concept of water as a diluent. Does that mean distilled water, as it does in many cases? If so, Do you search out a distilled water source or do you use tap water? Contact time. I say here, a few seconds in application may reflect what is done by your staff. However, on the label, it requires a few minutes of contact time. If you don't have that contact time, you're not getting the activity that is claimed on the label. And then, of course, there's different dilutions. And while bleach is perhaps the best, where you can have undiluted 1 in 10, 1 in 1,000, and 1 in 10,000, you have to understand that many times people will only look at one dilution as being what's going to be used everywhere. And so you have to have a checklist as to what dilution is going to be good for what environment. And in actual fact, the checklist movement has become huge when it comes to healthcare and patient safety, and I think that we should be looking at checklists regardless when it comes to cleaning and disinfection. Because quite honestly, if you have a checklist, it makes it much easier to follow than a very small label on a bottle. I will also say that directions are based on extensive testing of the active in laboratory environments. And the reason I say that is because, well, when you see the directions on the label, they come from laboratory-based studies. And the reason we do laboratory-based studies, as on the next slide, is the fact that you have to have laboratory-based claims. And so we have standardized methods, such as ASTM, AOAC, the European Union, Canada, the U.S. Everybody has their own. Paul mentioned Dr. Sitar earlier, and we're working with Dr. Sitar to try and harmonize all of these methods across the world. It's not particularly easy. However, what you do, all you really need to know at this stage is that there are validations for claims based on testing methods. And based on those test methods, you either have bactericidal, microbactericidal, sporicidal, viricidal, or fungicidal activity. I've put thresholds here. But what is really the take-home message is that once you have these claims, those lead to the directions. And once you have those directions, those lead to the actual application. And then I'm going to throw a wrench in all of that because last year, or actually at the end of 2009, I did a CBC story, Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. It's a national broadcaster in Canada, where we actually did some field use studies on hand antisepsis. And we compared that to the lab studies that I do here. And what we found is that the actual application in the field, in other words, just regular, average, ordinary Canadians using a hand sanitizer, didn't have anywhere near the activity that we saw in the lab. So that is another reason to have a checklist, because you have to try and adhere as closely as possible to what the directions are in order to get the claim that's on the label and the activity that you're looking for, or the kill that you're looking for. While this is not necessarily a wrench, there are other aspects that you need to take into account. The level of the active, we've already talked about the dilution effect. The test protocol. Okay. When we do test protocols in the lab, we can do suspension tests, we can do tests where we essentially do it on stainless steel, and we can also do skin-based tests. Those are highly, highly, highly specialized, highly structured, huge standard operating procedures, and everything is done specific so that we have the least amount of variation. That gives us a contact time that we know, according to our lab-based methods, works. As I mentioned with the CBC story, that is actually not the case in the field. So what you need to take home is that you need that wet contact between the active and the organism for a minimum of the contact time. If you go over, there's nothing wrong with that. If you also look at the idea of residual and persistent activity, you have to realize that a lot of the work that's been done with respect to residual and persistent activity is, again, not taking into consideration what actually happens in the field. So therefore, you can't just count on the residual. So if something says contact time of 3 minutes, make it 3 minutes, and then take it off. Don't make it a minute and then expect that the residual is going to fill for that 3 minutes. So it's very important that you take that with you, because if you don't have that as you're developing these checklists or these standard operating procedures, then you can't be absolutely sure that you're getting the proper cleaning. Other factors to consider, I've talked a little bit about the biofilms, but I'm going to also talk about now the idea that there could be load. And that is soil load, such as inorganic material. You could have bodily fluids. You could have food. You could have residual disinfectant or other components just sitting there. So you have to have a good visual identification of what you're going to clean. If it is not looking particularly ready to be disinfected, then do some manual pre-cleaning. What has to be understood, though, is that if you do the manual pre-cleaning, then there's a good likelihood that you're contaminating whatever you're using, and therefore you have to be careful that you don't spread using that cloth or whatever it might be to other surfaces. Because while pre-cleaning is absolutely great to be able to help you disinfect one particular surface, the last thing you want to do is spread whatever you're taking off that surface onto other surfaces. So be very careful as to how pre-cleaning is done. And again, a checklist would be perfect for that. Diluent. Again, we've talked about water. There could be other diluents as well. Do you need salt? Do you need any kind of other ingredient? Do you need in the case of some of the glutaraldehydes, you needed an activating solution to be putting into the diluent in order for it to work properly. So these are things that you need to worry about. And then, of course, fresh versus reusable. Again, in the glutaraldehyde sense, once you activated it, it was good for 28 days. Is that useful for other disinfectants and cleaning materials? Can you use a cleaning material again? In other words, can you clean something and then dip it back in and then clean something else? I'd say probably not. But again, this is all something that needs to be taken into consideration and then put into your protocols. So I've talked a lot about checklists. I've talked a lot about protocols. I've talked a lot about making sure that you're doing your job right. And a lot of that may come across as perhaps a bit lectury. It may come across as a bit too much. And in reality, a lot of people do feel that way. So what you want to do is you want to find out whether or not your cleaning methods are working, whether or not you follow everything I've been talking about, or whether you've got your own methods. And the only way to do that is through the development of an audit. And the audit is another one of these things that is really picking up steam in healthcare. The other thing that's very interesting about audits is that when you start mentioning that, you start widening the scope of the people who are going to be involved. And in my next slide, I talk about the fact that audits require collaboration. Now, I was at a meeting of a group of chief executive and chief financial officers for various hospitals, and they were very interesting because they kept stressing one word, and that was quality. They had to always have quality in their healthcare. And when we asked them, well, how do you have quality? They said, we do audits. And we thought that was great. Then we asked them, do you do environmental services or housekeeping audits? And they kind of just looked at you and went, well, why would we do that? And it was very interesting because one of the CEOs actually said, no, we actually involve our infection control, our environmental services, as well as our administration. And the reason for doing that is, really, when you're looking at an audit, okay, you have to take into account that the person who is doing the cleaning or the disinfecting is going to be really the frontliner for the health of the patient and the visitor. But should something happen to the health of the patient and the visitor, it's not going to be that frontline worker that's going to feel the heat. It's going to be the CEO and the CFO. So everybody needs to be involved when it comes to an audit. The audit should be conducted with defined objectives. Are we auditing clean versus disinfected? Are we auditing a routine cleaning disinfection, or is this terminal? Are we auditing residual? And what I mean by residual is when we do disinfection and cleaning, there's always going to be something left behind. But what are we leaving behind, and is it still safe? Now, in terms of reports on audits, they should reflect the goals of the hospital. And this is, again, where you have the administration coming in, talking about how their work plans and objectives must be met. Well, if you design an audit so that you're actually helping your administration, then you're going to be helping them help you by creating a work plan that actually helps. That makes you feel better, and you start creating this circle of positivity, circle of satisfaction, and things just go from there. In terms of methods for auditing, each hospital will have its specific method. There are benefits and drawbacks to each. I'm just going to mention a few here. The first one is, of course, microbial culture lab analysis. Point prevalence testing is along the same lines. It's actually very low cost, but it can be time-consuming. And when you are in the midst of an outbreak or a suspected positive, it can be very difficult for you to say, okay, well, let's wait 48 hours and we'll see. Sometimes you need something right away. There is PCR, which is becoming much more popular, polymerase chain reaction, and some things are happening now in real time. So we are starting to see a little bit better turnaround when it comes to doing this concept of microbial swabbing followed by analysis. Before sort of this real time measure was developed, a group about 5 to 10 years ago, came up with the concept of using adenosine triphosphate. So essentially what the adenosine triphosphate method does is it identifies what they consider to be metabolic activity, which then creates fluorescence, which is then measured, and then that can be related to microbial growth or microbial activity. The problem is that the fluorescence material that you use can also be activated or triggered by a number of other products, such as foods, such as residuals from just regular detergents. And in other cases, it may actually quench the fluorescence. It will make it less fluorescent as a result. And there have been studies, Journal of Hospital Infection being one of them, that showed that when you look at the ATP levels and then you try and compare them to the swab and culture method, that the actual ATP levels do not reflect the actual microbial load, and that ATP is more a sense of cleanliness than it is of microbial quality. And so ATP is fabulous in clean rooms for semiconductors and also in the food industry, but it really is not particularly useful when it comes to auditing microbial inactivation. A more recent development when it comes to auditing is fluorescent targeting, and this was developed by Phil Carling and has been published off and on. What I've taken here is from a conference that's actually coming up in 2011, where he uses a fluorescent goo. And they take this goo and they put it all over, and then you go through your regular cleaning. And then once you've completed that, they go back and they find out whether or not you've left any of the fluorescent goo. And in this graph, which is a little bit difficult to get, you'll actually notice that in many cases, top surfaces of tables, top surfaces of bed rails, they were able to pretty much completely remove all the goo. But if you look at, say, the bottom hand grip or the bottom of the handrail or the bathroom handrail, it was not removed at all. So in this particular case, the audit is showing that there are specific areas that are considered to be at risk, such as the handrail, but in actual fact are not getting the attention they deserve. The next concept for auditing is to take it away from the microbial lab, and these are more qualitative audits. And these audits are more systematic, and they really do involve the administration, infection control, more so perhaps than environmental services. But there is a reflection upon environmental services, which is why I believe they need to be involved. Long-term qualitative audit, and quite honestly, first thing first, levels of hospital-acquired infections. If your levels are down, that's a great thing. It means things are working great. If levels are up, things aren't working so great. If levels are up in specific areas and not in others, you need to investigate where the breakdown is. Adoption of staff. Are the staff actually interested in what is going on when it comes to environmental services? Is once a day or twice a day enough? Do nurses and other members of the healthcare staff appreciate what is going on when it comes to cleaning and disinfection? And also appreciation of the public. Nothing makes the public more happy than that nice clean smell, not the hospital smell, but a nice clean smell, as well as a clean environment so that they don't feel like there's a problem. I have a friend who runs one of the housekeeping departments here in Ottawa, and he actually does that. He'll just take a walkabout. And as he walks around, he'll just identify specific areas. And if he does see an area that to him, as a human being, as a member of the public, not as the director of housekeeping, makes him cringe, then he essentially notifies the people, usually by walkie-talkie, and says, hey, look, this area needs work. I need to know what's going on here. So, I mean, the walkthrough audit, which is just what I've described here, gives you not only the appreciation for the public, but also gives you an appreciation of what you would expect to have from the public. And again, it's very important to do that. A lot of people don't think that the public play a particular role in the hospital of cleanliness and disinfection, but in actual fact, the public play a huge role because they are the ones who bring the environment into the hospital. So if you give them the sense that it's clean and you give them the sense that they can do something to make their world cleaner, there's a good likelihood that a lot of them are going to pick up on that. And again, that circle of positivity happens. And then to continue along the circle of positivity, you have the attitude audit. So do the staff feel current protocols are working? Are the Environmental Services Infection Control Administration working as a team? And is there a general job satisfaction due to the environment? So what I'm trying to say here is that if the public appreciates it, then the staff's going to appreciate it. If there are lower levels of HAI, then, you know, people are going to have a better satisfaction. So at the end of the day, the whole concept of auditing is really to develop satisfaction. And as I put it here, do patients feel safer? Do visitors feel more comfortable in the hospital setting? Will visitors adopt a better hygiene as a result, such as increased use of hand sanitizer at the entrances? And if you have that satisfaction, it will translate into satisfaction at the worker level, whether it be a doctor, a nurse, a porter, an intern, or the housekeeping staff. And all of that, going back to that meeting I had the other day, is what we call quality. So if you want to help your health leaders, the CEOs and the CFOs, come up with quality, then talk to them about doing these types of audits, because that's going to be really, really helpful. Okay, last thoughts. Disinfection and asepsis are no longer just an environmental services issue. You require many departments to be involved. There has to be a framework for decision making. And as I've mentioned here, the five A's provide only the backbone to this framework. Now that you have these five A's and some of the perspective that I've given you, the onus is on you to now take that and start doing something with it. And it doesn't matter if it's a checklist, it doesn't matter if it's an algorithm, it doesn't matter if it's an entire revamping of the cleaning and disinfection at your institution. Do something. The information needs to be available and accessible. The five A's point to how decision trees and data can be classified and displayed. That's mainly for your administration. But if you can take to them something that they can appreciate, and more importantly, something that they can market, then you're going to have a much better return on this particular venture. I think the other thing is that we also have to realize that because pathogens represent one of the greatest threats to health in the hospital, pathogen reporting is becoming more popular. And we're starting to see this in the U.S. where all hospital-acquired or healthcare-acquired infections are going to have to be made public. So that is the future. And if you can stem the tide of infection, then it's going to look better on your institution. So again, you're contributing to the positivity of and the satisfaction of your institution. Finally, and I try and stress this point whenever I'm talking about something horribly and completely complicated, the easier the model, the faster the adoption once a decision is made, or as I like to call it, the keep it simple, stupid rule, the KISS rule. It is imperative that no matter how difficult, no matter how hard it is to work it with these five A's and develop a framework with all your stakeholders and all the communication, everything that goes on in order to make something happen, at the end of the day, all you're doing is you're trying to make the place better, you're trying to make the place safer, and you're trying to make the place more like the place you want to be. So with that, I shall leave it. And Paul, back to you.
Jason, thank you very much. That was a tremendous presentation. And you noted a couple of items that, in fact, we're going to be covering in teleclasses coming up this year. We have a lecture in June by Dr. Peter Provenost, one of the worldwide leaders in using checklists in healthcare. And his lecture on June the 9th is entitled Using Checklists to Prevent Healthcare-Associated Infections. And then later in the fall, on October the 6th, we will be talking about using metals and the reality behind metals. You also sent me some links, some reference links that I've posted in the notes area for this teleclass. So anyone who has registered for the teleclass, you can go to the same place where you got the slides and the handouts, and there are now three new lines there for the reference links. If there are any questions, please do send them to me. My email address is at the bottom of each of the handouts and on the title page of the slides. I'd like to thank Virox for their sponsorship of this teleclass in particular, but also for their support of the teleclass education program as a whole. They've been very good to us, and I am very grateful to them indeed. And Jason, thank you very much. Another tremendous presentation. This is your second or third teleclass, and although you are sometimes, shall I say, disruptive in your opinions, you are always well-referenced, and it's a great learning experience every time that I speak with you, so thank you very much for that.
Thank you so much, and I would just like to state that it's much better to be a firebrand than a firecracker. Firecracker makes a big pop, but 5 seconds later, nobody cares. A firebrand actually changes the world.
So thanks to everyone, and we'll look forward to talking with you again very soon. Goodbye.